Hey everybody, it's me, Matt Tinney.
And Niels Rosenbaum.
Thank you guys again. Niels was just giving me a hard time. We were laughing. Sorry. So, we have some more listener questions.
Oh, excellent.
Viewer, those are fun. Listener, or any questions like that?
They're listeners.
Listeners.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to... We have actually a bunch.
They're texting questions as they drive.
They're texting questions as they drive.
Good.
I just like how you picture everyone is in a car.
Everybody's in a car.
Do you picture a car or like an SUV or a truck? You picture
car.
A car. What color is the car?
It's white.
I'm assuming you have like this.
I have a car.
Mind.
Yeah.
Is it a man or a woman listening?
I guess it's usually a man.
Really? What is he doing? Just driving?
Just driving.
Is he going to work?
He's smiling because he's so happy because he's listening to our podcast.
Well, maybe this was Paul. Maybe we're talking about Paul here.
Hey, Paul.
So I have one from Paul J. in Virginia Beach. Virginia. We were in
nice.
Virginia.
Yeah, that
Beach.
Was fun.
I just remember that they had signs that you can't curse on the sidewalk.
Oh, that's right. And you stood in front of it and cursed.
Of course it did. It's like egging you on. My wife gets so mad because we'll be out at dinner. They're like, hey, watch out. This plate's hot. So right away, I touch it.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there has to be something for that because I'm an idiot. It's a case of idiosis. But it's the same thing. Like if something smells bad, you're like, oh my God, smell this or
this
taste
is
this.
So terrible taste. Yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, it's funny. People want to share in their experiences.
Yeah. I'm like, it can't be that hot. Oh, really? I can't cuss here? Watch this. And then I get arrested. But I'm sorry. Anyway.
Okay.
So Paul asked, and this is a doctor one, okay? So once you graduate and become a doctor, can you be any kind of doctor?
Well, it depends what you mean graduate from. So if you have to do college,
okay,
and then you have to do medical school. Medical school is 4 years, and that's when you get your MD, your medical doctorate.
Or a DO, you mentioned before.
Or a DO, a doctor of osteopathic medicine. And then once you get your credentials, your MD, in order to practice, you really have to do a residency. It used to be a long time ago that you could just kind of start hanging a shingle. You can't do that anymore.
What is a residency?
See, you choose the specialty that you want to go to.
So that's when you choose. Psychiatry.
And I chose psychiatry, so I had to do a 4-year residency. It's 4 years of training specific for psychiatry in addition to the 4 years of medical school.
On the job training or is
it
more class?
Okay. Yeah, you're paid.
So you get paid.
It's a paid internship.
So you paid to go to school, but then you get paid to learn.
Yes, that's exactly right. You just get paid less.
Right.
And you work more. Yeah.
But I guess, is that for any kind of doctor?
You know,
well, so let's say you're a psychiatrist.
I don't know what all the laws in all the states are, but you might be able to get away with just a 1-year general medicine. But no one's going to hire you. You might be able to hang a shingle legally and start seeing patients, but it's probably be hard to get insured. It would be hard to get covered by insurance. Most people want you to finish a residency. It's sort of a requirement.
Right. And so you're a psychiatrist, so you went to residency for psychiatry.
Yeah.
You have your medical doctorate degree.
Yes.
If you wanted to do family practice.
I'd have to do another residency. I'd have to go
and
back and
practice.
Do 3 more years.
But you wouldn't have to go back to college.
No.
What if you wanted to do, I don't know, ear, nose, and throat?
Same thing. I would have to, that would be, I think, 6 years because it's 3 years of general surgery and then 3 years at ENT.
But you then, you get paid just a lot less.
Yeah.
It'd be a pay cut.
Yeah, it'd be a pay cut.
Would they treat you different since you've already been a doctor for so long?
Well, they probably would. They would probably send all the psychiatric patients my way. And they'd probably ask me a lot of psychiatric questions. I remember there were a few people who were doing residency again, especially foreign grads always have to do residency again. So I looked into like moving to Finland, for example. I would have to do a residency there in order to practice in Finland. But if I go to Australia, they can just hire me.
Why is that? Are they just
because I guess
standard
they need more doctors than they trust our level of training. So if you come
but in Finland,
from,
they don't trust us.
I guess
like, you American
I didn't
doctors,
really look into
look
it a lot,
at,
but that's what
we need
we
to
do.
Monitor you.
We do that basically with the rest of the world. I think you have to do another residency if you.
So if someone was in
country.
School in Australia, was practicing there, but they moved to America for some reason, for them to practice medicine here, you're saying they'd have to go through that.
I'm not sure if it's true for all countries, but most countries, yeah.
And don't they have to take some kind of test?
Yeah, they'd have to take the board exams to be boarded.
How often do doctors – so what is it considered, psychiatry? Is that just your specialty?
That's my
practice?
Specialty.
How often do providers or doctors change your specialty?
Not too frequently. what sometimes so happens uncommon. Is you can do a combined. You can do like a family practice psychiatry. I think that's available somewhere. You can also, if you do family practice, you have a little bit more latitude. Like if you do family practice and then you realize, I really just like OB and you're kind of all your FP patients, family practice patients happen to be pregnant, then you're kind of doing OB, but you're still family practice. Or if you're family practice and you want to do psychiatry, just start seeing more of those patients and then you're doing everything a psychiatrist does, except your family practice. There was one guy in our residency training who was one of our attendings and he was a family practice doc. He never did a psychiatry residency.
He just practiced psychiatry.
He just practiced psychiatry, which is unusual.
If you practice it like him, he couldn't be considered a psychiatrist.
Well, people consider him a psychiatrist. Like I could technically, let's say if I really wanted to, I could find a doctor or a clinic who'd be willing to sort of oversee my care, and then I could just do family practice stuff. Yeah, I'm qualified to do that. So like if I wanted to work for healthcare for the homeless, I might be able to say, hey, I'll work for you cheaper and you give me a little training and then I'll be a family practice doc. But then they'll just give me all their psych patients.
Right.
Yeah. But legally I could do that. As long as they want to hire me, I can just kind of manage medical patients. Do that full time.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I guess
I like managing medical patients.
Right. I guess it opens a lot more doors.
Yeah.
That degree.
Yeah.
Can you practice like we were talking about people that are extremely overweight and they lose weight and then they have like
can I do surgery on them?
But they have the hanging skin. Yeah. What kind of medicine is that? Like dietary and God, like people
I think
get
that
like
would go to plastic surgery. Oh, you're not talking about taking
the
skin.
I'm talking about plastic surgery. There we go. Yeah. I don't know why that term was blank in my mind. Could you do plastic surgery?
I mean, I think legally I could, but I'd get sued so badly.
I mean, is that a residency or is that a different college course?
No, that's you do 3 years of general surgery and then however long plastic surgery is, it's got to be at least another 3 years.
So that's what I mean. I didn't know if it was a different baseline schooling.
No, it's the same school. Every plastic surgeon who's an MD has the same degree and went through the same kind of medical school that I did.
They just changed their residency.
Yeah, so they got an extra 7 or 8 years of training towards their specialty, where I got 4 years towards my specialty. That's where we diverged. But we're both part of that same kind of club where we both got an MD.
Right.
That's one of the things that separates psychologists from psychiatrists, is not just the degree and not just that we can prescribe medicine. It's sort of the club and being able to speak the language and talk stories about residency. It's just your kind of, it's like the difference between, I don't know, I can't think of something equivalent in law enforcement, but you could imagine.
Well, I mean, I guess in law enforcement, your specialties would be detectives.
Yeah.
I mean, your detectives specialize in, you know, one will have homicide versus robbery versus domestic violence.
But it's much, much more fluid.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think anyone could kind of hop in and do an investigation.
I mean, I guess the extreme version would be like a cop versus, you know, a corrections officer or a security guard. You know, you both feel like, oh, we're sort of have some kinship, but no, the training is completely different. I don't know. There's not a good analogy. But anyway,
that's
what binds all doctors together, is that experience of medical
school. And your guys' secret little
and
club.
And usually the first year of internship is kind of the same for everybody. It sucks.
The first year of internship? Do you guys all do one type of internship?
So residency is like, say, 4 years.
Right.
No matter what residency you do, the first year is called an internship.
Okay.
I don't know why that is. So your first year of residency is an internship. And during internship, you're usually getting more of a broad general medical overview. So if you're doing surgery, you're doing a lot of what's called off service. So you'll do family practice, internal medicine. You'll do all those different rotations. And so the similarities between all doctors' training doesn't end just at
school.
School.
Right.
That first year of internship is very similar among all.
Well,
residents.
What do you mean by you do rotation? So, like, you'll go and practice, or you'll be a doctor in a family practice place.
So, if you go to the hospital, you go to UNM, and you have to get a neurologic exam. You go in, and the doctor says, "Hi, I'm Dr. Rosenbaum. How are you? Please." They don't say, "Oh, by the way, this is my first year of training."
Right.
They just say, "You know, I'm the resident, and I'm here to see you." And they do the exam, and you wouldn't know.
Right.
They're just part of the team, and they do that for anywhere from 1 to 3 months. And then they switch, and now they're the family practice doc. And then they switch again, and now they're the internal medicine doctor. So they're just part of a team, sort of rotating through different
just specialties. So you have a broader knowledge of actual application.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Which is great. I mean, especially for psychiatrists. If you,
I wonder why they don't do that in other jobs. I'm just comparing it now to law enforcement. We don't do that.
Yeah, it would be nice.
I think
to rotate, yeah. Do a month of your training with one detective and another with another detective.
Right. Yeah. I would think you have a broader skill what you should look for. Because, yeah. I mean, you're going to start off in the field, but
yeah.
If you had a better understanding of what evidence should I ask, what questions should I ask, it would be helpful. Interesting.
Change that.
I mean, it would be possible. Yeah. When I went on.
Even a week would be worthwhile. If you did a week with every subspecialty, you'd learn a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think they try to get just officers out as soon as possible and on the street taking calls.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're on the job training now is 3.5 months, but it's all just you ride with another officer, your field training officer.
3.5 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause then I mean, that's come after inside the academy. And you don't even know what it's really like.
Right.
That's interesting.
And so, I mean, it
half the department's inside.
For our department. Yeah. Yes.
That's unusual high.
I'm not sure the ratio, but I would think it would be high. Yeah.
That seems high.
Yeah, but it's your specialty.
Yeah, it would be nice to rotate through at least some of the key ones like homicide, robbery.
Right. Any of the investigations. Yeah. I mean, you could go to just like if you have a unit that does general investigations, just kind of knowing how to do the paperwork.
Like impact.
Right. What the DAs look for.
Yeah.
How to have effective questioning that's not leading, things like that.
No, I think that's a great idea.
I mean, it used to be that you had to sit with dispatch. You would go with the K-9 unit. You would do some other ones like that, but you never had that.
Now they just come in and lecture for an hour, and it goes right over their heads.
Right.
You have to learn it practically. Because I mean, especially with medicine, you learn about all the diseases, but until you're actually taking responsibility for a case, it doesn't really sink in. Until you do a lumbar puncture, you can read all about it, but you have to do it. Yeah, to know what
I don't
it
want
feels.
You doing a lumbar
I'm
puncture.
Qualified, though, Matt.
I just want I want everyone to know this is my official
curl
thing.
Up in the ball.
At any point, if you guys are like, I wonder if Neil should do this lumbar puncture on Matt. Everyone say no. That was not what he asked for. I mean, unless I would die. Otherwise, there would be no reason for that.
For you dying?
Without a lumbar puncture. There would be no emergency medicine for that.
If you had really high intracranial pressure or something, maybe.
But like we're randomly somewhere.
It's diagnostic almost always.
I don't want to be like hiking with you or out somewhere and you'd be like, oh, my head hurts. Get in a ball. I'm puncturing this. Not going to happen.
Well, that's an interesting question. So we digress.
I hope that answered you, Paul. But the next question we have is from Zach H. He's from Brentwood, Tennessee.
Okay.
I think he's up to no good. But this is his question. If I ask if you are a cop, do you have to tell the truth?
That's an interesting question.
What do you think?
I think no. I think if you're dressed in a uniform, you can't say, oh, I'm not a cop. I mean, if you're representing yourself as a police officer, but I'm assuming if you're undercover, you don't have to tell somebody because then they'd murder you.
Well, you're legally obligated to tell somebody if they ask you.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So undercover?
Even undercover. So if you're trying to buy drugs right now and you ask and they tell you they're not a cop, they're not a cop. So just believe them, buy the drugs.
Oh, I get
everything
it.
Everything on that. No, you're right. You're not obligated.
You had me going
to.
There for a second.
I was like, no way.
Really?
I'm going to ask everybody. Yes, you do not have to tell someone that you're a police officer. And that's the point.
Until
right
you
there.
Arrest them.
Right. And a lot of times with undercover stuff, the one that's making the purchase, or whatever it is on that, isn't the one making the arrest.
Oh, that makes sense. They're just gathering the information. Okay.
Because I'm sure that could
that
create
would blow
all kinds
their cover,
of,
too.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. You do not have to do it. And it just reminds me
is
of...
Is he planning on trying to buy drugs or something?
I'm wondering. I'm going to write him back. Let me just give you some resources for a drug-free lifestyle. But there was a officer here named Todd that was on a bunch of Cops episodes.
Okay.
And I just always remember there was one where he did Vice, so they did a lot with prostitution and drugs.
Okay.
And he's picking up prostitutes.
Okay.
And the woman goes, oh, you look like Todd. He's like, Todd, who's that? And she's like, oh, it's a cop. Wow, you guys look so – or is that you? And he's like, no, that's not me. And it was him, you know. But, I mean, it's interesting people have this idea that you have to tell somebody that you're a cop.
Well, the question I always had is how much of the law can an undercover person break?
So, I don't think you can break the law to enforce the law.
So if like you're in a situation where maybe someone, I know this is all like movies and TV shows, but let's say you're undercover, Matt, and it's like with some pretty bad dudes, and they're all, they might suspect that you're a cop, and they're all like smoking dope, and then they pass it to you.
Yeah.
Or they test you in some other way.
Right.
You know? Do you just you can't be like, do no, it. I can't. Why not? Because of my lungs. You know,
like. Right. It would be a hard one. I don't think that you can break the law. I'm sure on some of those, though, that you're mentioning is bigger and federal. Okay. So I don't know if federal law enforcement has different regulations.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah.
So if you're in a federal law enforcement and you're doing undercover, they may allow you to do X amount of drugs. I have no clue. I would find it very hard in court, though. Because then someone would be like, well, I've done drugs. Did you do drugs with them? Yes. Did you have a clear mind then? How do you know they're breaking the law? Are you just upset? You know, you would lose your credibility.
Did you see the movie The Departed?
Yes. That's when you were just talking about movies and you mentioned it, that's exactly what I was thinking.
They all did all sorts of terrible illegal things.
Right.
But everybody was crooked.
Right. Yeah. That was such an interesting movie.
Well, that would be an interesting one to look into to see if feds can do illegal stuff.
I just think you would lose your credibility.
Makes sense.
It'd be hard for you to be a witness and then...
But it would also be hard to be undercover if you have to follow the letter of the law perfectly.
Right.
You'd be like, gentlemen, we have to file our taxes on this laundered money. You know, what are you going to
do? Well, so, I mean, I think it could be things like that. Like
you're allowed to look away from crimes?
I think, like, you might be able to engage in the activity to document it if it is stuff that is, like, embezzlement.
Okay.
Where it doesn't affect a human being.
Oh, okay.
Well, like dealing, like using drugs would affect you. So it would compromise your mindset for your investigation.
Okay.
But if it was something like, let's say you were undercover in a big gang that was selling drugs.
Okay.
You might go out and ship the drugs, and you might even be part of the selling process, like watching it and seeing that.
Okay. You can do that as APD too.
Right.
Okay. And so that's breaking the law.
Right.
Okay.
But those are the laws that you're documenting. Like, that is a violation of the law that you're charging someone for. So you're there witnessing that violation.
And participating in.
Now, but see, if you make it up. So let's say I'm undercover. I'm like, I really want to get these guys for selling dope.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, hey, guys, let's go sell some dope.
That's framing them.
Right.
Okay. Entrapment.
Right. Okay. So that's the difference.
Hey, guys, let's go sell some dope. Yeah. You'd be great undercover, man.
Hey, guys, want to go? Would you like some drugs? But do you see what I'm saying? It's tricky.
It's hard.
I think a lot of it is more of like you try to just blend into this group and see what's going to happen. You're kind of like a person in the background is what your goals are.
Yeah, but that's hard. You'd think criminals would figure that out. Like, why isn't this guy taking the lead on anything?
Right. But, I mean, a lot of organizations, you have to wait till you take the lead.
Because you could just say, like, if you're undercover and I suspect it, I could say, oh, here's a $50,000 worth of meth. Why don't you go sell it? And I'm going to watch you to make sure you do it right.
Right.
And then you're screwed, right?
Well, no. I mean, you'd have to set it up. It'd be interesting. Yeah. I mean, are you giving it an out? You just make sure if you think someone's a cop, you give them $50,000 worth of drugs and make them sell it. But I mean, I think that some of it, I'm sure if that happened, you could get other cops to come buy it.
Oh, okay.
You know, but...
Sure, let me call a friend.
Right. Oh, okay. I have some hookups. Yeah, I mean,
I guess
would be...
guess you're true, huh?
Yeah.
And they'd have to bring... Wow, it's complicated.
It is. I
sounds
think
like a horrible
hard.
Life.
Right.
Oh, I'd hate that.
And so I think a lot of
especially in a relatively small town like this.
Right. Yeah. But you have to realize I think a lot of what we think is undercover, we associate with movies and that's just not real life. Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of times undercover is you're more meeting with people that like confidential informants.
Okay.
They're the ones giving you information rather than you trying to break into a organization because of what you're saying. It's hard. You can't just be like, oh, you want to do drugs? We're all doing drugs. Yeah, I'll just pass right now. You know, let's go sell some drugs. Cool. I got to take a break.
Yeah, you think it would have to be federal. Then you can move someone from their home state and they can do something there and that kind of stuff.
Because a lot of the stuff that you hear of like these big, like they, you know, went into a biker gang or they did, you know, into the mob. That's all federal agents.
Yeah, yeah.
It's never local. So that's
why
I don't.
A federal agent.
I would be, you know, I'd be worried to get too into the cultures.
Oh, yeah, huh?
I think that would be hard.
I would never want to do that.
Well, do you know what I mean? Because no matter what, like if you're put in with a group of people, you make friends with people.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think it would be hard to
turn that off.
Yeah, especially if you're there for years. Like some people have been in like organizations for 15 years.
Seriously?
Yeah, like trying to work their way up, get more information.
Wow. You can see how they become like double agents or corrupt.
Right.
Yeah.
I can see where it gets tricky. And they get arrested.
Oh, yeah, they get arrested, but not for real.
No, I mean, they go through the process, and then eventually it's like, oh, they get shipped to another location, and they're pulled.
Oh, they have to go in but then jail you're for done. A little while.
You can't go back to that organization. You can't be undercover anymore.
Once you've been arrested.
Yeah, how would you? What would be your story? Hey, we all ended up over here. Where did you go? Why did they pull you out randomly?
But you could just be let off at a technicality in the trial, like half of them anyway.
But if it was in a trial, then you had to be in jail for up until that trial. True. It's interesting. It's tricky.
Oh, well, that's cool.
It's a hard one.
Is that the? Was there one more?
We have a lot, but we normally only do two.
How much time do we have? Yeah.
Did you want me to try to do another one?
No, that's fine.
Here, we'll do another quick one.
Okay.
Are you ready? So this was from Norman. Okay. Or no, this is from Steve in Norman, Oklahoma.
Stephen Norman.
No, Steve from Norman, Oklahoma.
Okay.
So he just asks, do you guys have interests outside of the job?
Yes.
No. Yes, we do. What are you interested outside of mental health or law enforcement?
Oh, lots of stuff. I mean, obviously the primary interest is my family. That sort of eclipses everything. And then, you know, hobbies. That kind of stuff.
You like knitting and
knitting, crochet.
He likes to make fake flowers and then he decorates flowers, places. Yeah. He's really into some cool things.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. I'm just saying it's nice that you do that.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, there's not a hint of sarcasm.
No, they're very beautiful things you're doing.
Thank you.
Yes, we have interests outside of it.
And that, you know, it's interesting that you bring up interest, but that's an essential component for a healthy law enforcement is to have outside interests, balance your family and friends outside of the department.
Wouldn't that be for any career, though?
Yeah, that's probably true for any career, but I think more so in law enforcement. I mean, if all your friends are from the insurance agency, it's not going to warp your mind. You know what I mean? It might give you a weird slant on the world.
Right.
But if you're only around cops and telling cop stories, you get this... You start to take on that's how the world is all the time.
If all it is death and destruction and all these.
Like, I look at the world through psychiatric glasses, you know, even when I'm not at work. And if all my friends were psychiatrists, I'd probably get a little weirder and have more. But it wouldn't,
your glasses would become round-rimmed. Yes. You would get a goatee. And a pipe would all of a sudden. Yes, I can see that you're slow more. Yes, I would say having interests outside of the job is important. You know, family is big. I think people always overlook that. I love cycling and racing bikes. But before that, I loved hockey. It just all of a sudden, my hockey teams always ended up being cop teams. It's like any kind of like adult sporting league. It's like all of a sudden someone hears like, oh, there's a cop on that team. The next league, oh, well, we're cops. We should be together. And it just, we all kind of congregate back. Cops versus everyone. Yeah. It's strange. But I would think it'd be the same. Like, if you're a psychiatrist, I am too. We should be on the team together.
We should be on opposite teams in battle.
Yeah. Well, you know, I could see that. But yes, we have interests outside
of it. Same croquet team. Yeah. Polo.
See, do you press flowers with the other psychiatrists?
Yes.
Look at this new one I collected today. It's so nice. What hobbies do you have?
I have lots of hobbies. I have.
You don't actually press flowers.
No.
No.
That sounds nice, though.
Yeah. Name one hobby you have.
I play guitar. I paint.
Well, you do paint.
You know, I always have some interest that I'm reading about, like something that's catching my. Like lately, it's.
Your sleep. Diet. Okay, well, hold on. Is sleep and diet a hobby?
Yeah, I guess diet is probably a hobby. I'm always interested in health and nutrition. So, but like I'll take on I got this stuff from my mom. Like she'll take on a subject and just teach herself all about it. And I do that occasionally.
Interesting.
Like,
okay.
I got really hooked on the weather once and I spent like 6 months reading weather books. And now I know a lot about the weather.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's fun.
But I guess, because what defines a hobby then? Just an interest?
It's an interest that you spend time on and it's usually produces something, I'm guessing. I don't really know. I can look up a definition.
I mean, I guess
looking up a definition.
The producing would be the pleasure you get from it.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about the diet because I know you're on a specialty diet now and a lot of our friends are.
Diets start to feel like hobbies, absolutely. Like cooking. So the cooking that goes along with it is definitely a hobby. Like I'm learning how to cook lentils.
Right. I think people consider cooking a hobby quicker than they do a diet.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking our friends are all into this intermediate fasting. But they're doing research on it.
No,
they're
an activity done regularly in one's leisure time for pleasure.
Wow. So
diet
are
could be. Like I find it pleasurable to read about it and to do it and eat my fruit smoothies and all that nonsense.
I just realized my hobby is trying to make fun of you. This is horrible. I find pleasure at trying to nitpick.
And it's bad because I find pleasure in that, too.
See?
It's a
sadomasochistic. We have bad hobbies. our weird bullying nature is a hobby. Well, thank you guys so much for sending in your questions. Don't forget to send in more. Anything that you guys would like us to answer or have questions about law enforcement or medicine or mental health or anything in between like that, send it to ask@gocit.org. And please enjoy the upcoming didactic that's from the CIT Echo. You guys can see more of that at gocit.org. If you're in public safety and like to join these weekly meetings, send Jen Earhart an email at jearhart@capq.gov. If you guys have enjoyed this episode, don't forget to share it with your friends, like it on Facebook, and follow us on Facebook. Just follow the Crisis Intervention Team on Facebook. And if you guys are listening on iTunes, again, we do this as a hobby, actually. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to know that you guys are liking it. Leave us a review if you guys like. Anyway, we'll talk to you guys soon.
Thanks. Bye.
So I do overdose prevention education and naloxone distribution statewide under two federal grants. One, the prescription drug opioid overdose grant, and also the opioid state targeted response grants. I train all the way from a person who injects heroin to Senator Martin Heinrich's office. I've trained hundreds of people over the last couple of years, and including recently really focusing on law enforcement statewide. I have trained Clayton PD, I've trained San Juan County Sheriff, I've trained Union County Sheriff, I've trained Border Patrol, Lordsburg PD, Santa Fe PD, just really going all over the state and training officers to recognize and respond to a suspected opioid overdose using naloxone hydrochloride, or in our case, it's a brand name is Narcan, that you may have seen. So I'll go through this, and please feel free to, I don't know how, what sort of, you know, protocols you have for the meeting, but I tend to be conversational and allow people to chime in and ask questions. And this is obviously a little bit didactic, but it's also, I like to engage people. So feel free to chime in. I'm just going to give you a little overview about the opioid overdose epidemic in New Mexico and a little bit nationally. Naloxone, and then talk briefly about illicitly manufactured fentanyl and what it looks like in the United States versus New Mexico. And then there will be resources available to you, specifically to the law enforcement officers, to be able to look at some of the, to really feel safer in your work. And talk in terms of science about illicitly manufactured fentanyl and exposure to it. Sorry, this computer will sometimes.
You can just click the background sometimes. And then.
So we're going to talk a little bit about overdose death data in New Mexico, talk about opioids, other substances, and naloxone to reverse an opioid overdose. Talk about state statute as it relates to law enforcement exemption from criminal and civil liability when responding to an opioid overdose. And then I'm not a scientist, but just to try to understand a little bit about the science of exposure to illicitly manufactured fentanyl. Between 1990 and 2015, the overdose death rate in New Mexico tripled. As you can see, in 1990, we were at 7.6 per 100,000. In 2015, we were 24.8, and actually, since I put this together, the 2016 data came out, next bullet below, you can see we're at 25.2 per 100,000, where the U.S. is at 19.8 per 100,000. It's important to note that we dropped out of the top 10 for really the first time in the last two decades. We've been number one, two, or three for most of the last 20 years. This is not new in New Mexico. We've been dealing with prescription opioid and heroin overdose deaths since pretty much the end of the Vietnam era. We are sort of plateauing right now, but it's not because we're doing super great. It's just that it's really bad in other parts of the country. in Kentucky and West Virginia and Ohio and up the eastern seaboard into New England. But we still have the highest overdose death rate in Rio Riba County in the United States at 84.8 per 100,000. This is per year?
Yeah.
Pardon?
Per year?
Yes.
Per day, Niels.
Overdose, as you probably have heard from the news now, is the leading cause of death for people under 50 in the United States, killing more people than firearms and motor vehicle accidents. So just briefly, a little overview of opioids. Opioids are medications that are, and if the physicians in the room want to chime in, please feel free. Opioid medications are used to treat physical pain, but they also have an effect on emotional and psychological pain. They produce euphoria. They can act as an antidepressant. And also, I think most importantly, one of the properties is this notion of dissociation, where you, a person who's using an opioid, who's not having such a great time in life, feels like their life is temporarily somewhere else, and that that crappy life they have is over there and it's not their own. That's pretty powerful when you're talking about people who probably have untreated emotional and psychological issues associated with past trauma or any multitude of things in dealing with life's challenges. The other thing about opioids, this is the reason we're here, is that in doses that are too high, they cause your body's own drive to breathe to be depressed. So they, in doses too high and in doses mixed with other respiratory depressants, they slow your breathing down to the point where it can eventually stop. And then once breathing stops, then in a couple of minutes, depending on your body's physiology, you go into cardiac arrest. Prescription opioids include Percocet, Dilaudid, prescription fentanyl, Vicodin, Lortab. You can read the list there. It's also important to note, I think, that although it's a partial, what's called a partial opioid agonist, buprenorphine, which is used to treat opioid dependence, is also an opioid. And then around the country, we're seeing illicitly manufactured fentanyl in the form of fake pills, where they are pressed to look like something that you would get from a pharmaceutical company, but they are much stronger dosages and are killing people who are buying diverted or fake pills on the streets. Also, in other parts of the United States, not in New Mexico, we are seeing illicitly manufactured fentanyl in the heroin supply. Just as a point of note, in order to stay ahead of this from a public health and public safety perspective, we are currently testing black tar heroin in northern New Mexico for the presence of fentanyl. We bought fentanyl test strips and are testing heroin samples at syringe exchange sites. And since September, we have had zero positive results for fentanyl in the black tar heroin. The respiratory depressant effects of opioids are made worse by alcohol and also by the class of medications, benzodiazepines, which are used to treat anxiety. And Dr. Duhigg, sometimes to help people sleep, is that correct?
The benzodiazepines?
Yes.
From old school doctors.
Okay. So there are old school doctors who prescribe benzodiazepines to help people sleep. And then there are other like sleeping pills, and then some antipsychotic medications like Seroquel also make the respiratory depression effects worse. People who inject heroin and methamphetamine or heroin and cocaine are also at risk for increased respiratory depression. And it's not uncommon for doctors to prescribe opioids and a benzodiazepine concurrently. And people who aren't given proper education don't know that alcohol is also a respiratory depressant. So they may be taking an opioid for pain and a benzodiazepine for anxiety, and then like to have a couple cocktails at dinner, and all those three drugs alcohol, opioid, and benzodiazepine are really a deadly cocktail in terms of overdose risk. So, in 1971, the FDA approved naloxone hydrochloride as an opioid antagonist. That's the opposite of the opioid agonists that I showed you earlier, that temporarily antagonizes an opioid off of the receptor site. The Narcan that I distribute comes in a box like this with two blister packs inside. There are 4 milligrams each in 1.1 cc of solution. I'm going to do a little demo here if I can.
I think we can even zoom in on you. Do you want to zoom in?
So you can see how easy.
We're going to switch the screen so that you show up on the screen.
That I don't know how to do.
This could probably see it from here.
Have you not been sharing? You're viewing PowerPoint screen. Under view options?
I know in Jen's, there's two different cameras on him right now.
So you just take the Narcan out of the blister pack. It requires no assembly. Put this in the person's nose and depress the plunger. And there you have the full dose in one spray. And then that device would be finished.
So Bernie, just to clarify, no needles come out and nobody gets stuck or anything?
No, there is no. This goes in the person's nose and it comes out in one, no needles, no assembly. This is not now a biohazard. This is trash.
What if you get boogers on it? Then is it biohazard?
Boogers aren't a biohazard.
See, Ben? That's why you can eat them now.
So the Narcan, and we use brand name Narcan nasal spray because these are federal grants, and the Feds, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, requires us to use a device that is approved by the FDA for nasal delivery. There are other nasal delivery devices many of you may be familiar with, the orange box with the atomizer you screw on top. That is an off-label use and not approved by the FDA, so we use this spray. This is public interest pricing. This is $75 a box. So that's two doses for $75. And again, that's public interest pricing. That's not retail pharmacy price or copay. This medicine only works for 30 to 90 minutes to displace the opioid and restore the person's own respiratory drive. It is safe, extremely effective. There is no abuse potential. It cannot be diverted. If it is used on a person not overdosing on an opioid, nothing will happen. In the mid-1990s, I was a paramedic. I gave naloxone all the time to people who were unconscious and not breathing, and I didn't know why. So it's used as a rule-out medication. Since I'm on this slide, I will say that this has a 2-year expiration date from the date of manufacture. It needs to be stored between 59 and 77 degrees with excursions on either end, up to 104 degrees. Freezing is really not advised, and I have told law enforcement officers around the state that if they suspect that their kit is frozen, they've left it in the car overnight, to let me know and I will take the kit out of service and replace it with another one. Also, just so you know, I've been working with law enforcement for a couple of years. A lot of agencies want to carry this in a Pelican kit in their car. And I did a temperature test last summer with a Pelican kit in my car for 2 hours and it was over 120 degrees. So what I recommend is in this blister pack, there are some officers who just carry it in their shirt. Some officers who put it in a pocket, in the side pocket of your pants, where it's like like military kind of pants. Some officers will just keep it in their car with the air conditioning on or with the heat on, depending on what season it is, and then making sure they take it into their house if they drive their duty vehicle home at the end of the shift. What else?
Yes, sir. So, question. So, this is matching with APD. So, you just demonstrated how, I guess, to administer it. How much has to go into the nasal cavity? Like, what if someone accidentally misses and only half goes in? Is it still effective? Or,
well, obviously, a full dose would be more effective. The thing is that you have a second dose that you could then apply, put in the person's nose. The intervention that I teach when I'm teaching law enforcement officers or anybody else actually is not only giving the medicine, but also performing rescue breathing. When someone is having an opioid overdose, their body's not craving naloxone, it's craving oxygen. So we want to get, whether you have a bag valve mask or whether you have a face mask or whatever it is that you might be using, to ventilate the person and to do Narcan every 3 minutes. So not getting a full dose in, could be, a lot of things could happen. This is a pretty high dose. This is 4 milligrams. I've never gave somebody 4 milligrams of Narcan intramuscular or intravenously when I was a paramedic, because you can titrate that delivery device to patient effect. This you can't titrate. So why teach people to give this every 3 minutes to give the medicine a chance to work? So if you were doing rescue breathing for somebody and you think you gave a partial dose, I would continue rescue breathing for 3 minutes and then give the second dose, because sometimes rescue breathing alone can revive a person who's in respiratory arrest from an overdose. Oh, I guess I forgot about this slide. So there's the tier expiration from the manufacturer date, the temperature range. Naloxone hydrochloride or Narcan is a very stable medicine. What is thought to happen over time, even after expiration, is that it's just not as effective. The United States Army did a study where Narcan or naloxone still worked 10 years after it had expired. In terms of law enforcement monitoring of this, if I was to do a training for any of the agencies online right now, I would be monitoring your expiration date. Such that I would contact whoever was the contact person 4 to 6 months prior to expiration and trade it out for newer medicine, so that I could take the law enforcement agency's medication and get it into the community before it expired. And as we certainly don't want professional agencies, having expired medicine to use. So that's part of the resource that I offer to law enforcement agencies, is monitoring that medication and then trading it out prior to expiration. Here's a quick cartoon of naloxone in the brain. On the left, you see heroin, morphine, and OxyContin on the receptors. And when Narcan is introduced, it temporarily displaces the opioid. You have a reversal of respiratory depression, and if for someone who's opioid dependent, they may experience withdrawal symptoms. Here's some relevant state statutes that I think it was important for you all to know. The legislation that passed in 2016 is how I'm able to be before you today with my own standing order. To purchase, store, and distribute the medication to anyone who would be in a position to respond to an opioid overdose, or anyone who is at risk for an opioid overdose. I have a standing order from Carly Bonham, Dr. Bonham at the University of New Mexico. And I also have a more localized standing order for Santa Fe and Rio Riba counties from Dr. Bill Weiss, who's a retired New Mexico Department of Health doctor. Where this applies specifically to state law enforcement, this is any law enforcement agency operating in the state of New Mexico. That includes state, local, county, municipal, border patrol, BIA, tribal police. Dr. Mike Landon, who's our state epidemiologist, wrote a law enforcement specific standing order for you officers to carry and use naloxone under his standing order. And in red, you see the stray from the statute, your exemption from civil liability, criminal prosecution, or professional disciplinary action as a result. I don't need to read it to you, but you can see. Also, as many of you probably know, House Bill 370 passed, not this session, but the session before in 2017, which basically requires all law enforcement agencies in the state to carry and use naloxone. So it's that bill has made me a very popular fellow in the state because I have law enforcement calling me from places I haven't even heard of, like Logan, New Mexico. I'm going to be training their officers in a couple weeks in Duke and Cary with the Quay County Sheriff's Office. So a lot of departments are wanting to be in compliance with the House bill. And for those of you who may be in a leadership role, I have the training for me is free, and the nasal Narcan spray is also free. We just ask that you report on any reversals that you may have. Just so you all know, there are 30 law enforcement agencies trained in New Mexico since January of 2017. Santa Fe Police Department has had 30 reversals since November of 2016, including a young man that I happen to know. The ambulance and the fire engine were lost on this call. And one of the officers I had trained a week earlier saved a young man that I know. So for those of you who live and work in small communities, you understand the links that how this impacts all of us. I trained Las Vegas, New Mexico Police Department last July 24th. And on July 26th, they had their first save in the back of a car. So since I made this presentation, San Juan County Sheriff's Office has also reported their first reversal.
Bernie, if somebody on the network wanted to get that training, how would they reach out to you, or is that later?
They
in your slides.
I think I give my contact information at the end. If I don't, I can certainly do that. Also, just so you know, there are more than 1,400 police departments in the United States now who. Not only are responding with naloxone in some smaller communities, law enforcement officers are actually giving Narcan to family members when they respond to an overdose at a house. So just to really briefly talk about illicitly manufactured fentanyl, again, to reiterate, we have not seen this in New Mexico yet. You all would know more than I do, but from what I understand, one of the reasons is that the drug cartels that control the coast of the United States do not control New Mexico, and that New Mexico is mostly a pass-through state. Again, you would know more about that than I do, but that's what I hear in my talking with law enforcement officers and the DEA and the U.S. Attorney's Office here. So here's just a couple of quotes about exposure to fentanyl in the line of duty. And I don't need to read you these quotes, but I have some peer-reviewed journal articles from physicians and researchers who say that it's almost physiologically impossible for some of the stuff that's been reported in the media to actually have happened, and that officers have been responded to with copious amounts of naloxone and their level of consciousness and did not change. There's research that shows that anybody who's been given 10 milligrams of naloxone and does not respond in terms of level of consciousness and respiratory rate is not having an opioid overdose. And I would defer to the physicians in the room. But so basically what that's saying is that suspected opioid overdoses from exposure to carfentanil by police officers did not respond to naloxone. And even illicitly manufactured fentanyl does respond to naloxone. That's the good news, is that in the line of duty, if any officer was ever to actually experience an opioid overdose and a fellow officer was carrying medication, it would work on illicitly manufactured fentanyl. There is also some misinformation that's been in the media about that, that naloxone does not work on fentanyl or fentanyl prescription or illicitly manufactured fentanyl, and it does. It may take more, but it rescue breathing and administration of naloxone reverses the effects. So I'm going to give these a bunch of articles and actually personal protective equipment recommendations from this journal. You'll be able to access those, I guess, on the listserv at some point in the next day or two when I get those to Jen. Also, I already mentioned this, that we have been testing black tar heroin in northern New Mexico since September and have had zero positive tests for fentanyl. And that's kind of what I've got in case, just to leave time for questions and comments and concerns.